Voice, Jeff Custer with this worldwide news update. Palestinian medics report Friday Israeli military strikes killed at least 30 Palestinians overnight in the Gaza Strip, most of them in the Nusayrat camp at the center of the enclave, after tanks pulled away from an area they had raided. Meanwhile, the Israeli military reports its warplanes fired on targets in southern Lebanon Thursday after detecting activity by the militant Hezbollah group. The attack was the first Israeli airstrike after a ceasefire between Israeli and Hezbollah took hold earlier this week. The World Health Organization said Thursday the ceasefire agreement in Lebanon provides an opportunity to address urgent humanitarian needs in the country. The WHO representative for Lebanon, Abdinassar Aboubakar, told reporters he was optimistic some hospitals could be back in operation quickly.
Probably some hospitals will take some time, but some hospitals probably will be able to restart very quickly. For example, there are four hospitals, two in Beirut, two outside Beirut, that probably will be able to operationalize for the next 4 weeks if the ceasefire remains intact.
Several buildings in Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, were reportedly damaged Friday following a Russian overnight drone attack. Meanwhile, Ukrainian soldiers deserting their posts are robbing the Ukrainian army of desperately needed manpower and crippling its battle plans at a crucial time in its war with Russia. Associated Press correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
Soldiers, lawyers, and Ukrainian officials tell the AP that tens of thousands of tired and bereft Ukrainian troops have walked away from combat and frontline positions. According to military commanders and soldiers, entire units have abandoned their posts, leaving defensive lines vulnerable and accelerating territorial losses. Some take medical leave and never return. Others clash with commanders and refuse to carry out orders, sometimes during firefights. The war has largely been going Russia's way, and the desertions could put Kyiv at a clear disadvantage in future ceasefire talks. I'm Karen Chamas.
This is VOA News. Police clashed with pro-European Union protesters in the Georgian capital of Tbilisi early Friday after the country's ruling party said the government would suspend talks on EU membership and refuse budgetary grants from the bloc until 2028. Reuters correspondent Gabe Singer reports.
Police ordered protesters to disperse, fired water cannons, and deployed pepper spray and tear gas as masked young people tried to smash their way into the parliament. Georgia has long been among the most pro-Western of the former Soviet states. Opinion polls show that around 80% of citizens support EU membership, and the aim of EU accession is written into the country's constitution. However, Georgia's relations with the EU have deteriorated sharply in recent months, with Brussels alleging that the Georgian Dream governing bloc had adopted pro-Russian stands and pushed through bills that critics have called authoritarian. Those moves led the EU to suspend Georgia's application for membership. Georgia Dream denies that it is pro-Russian and says it is committed to democracy and integration with the West, though it has, in recent years, deepened ties with Russia.
That was Reuters correspondent Gabe Singer reporting. Democratic members of the U.S. Congress from the northeastern U.S. state of Connecticut are reporting they received bomb threats at their homes Thursday. AP correspondent Norman Hall reports.
Their offices say at least five Democratic members of Congress from Connecticut were targeted by bomb threats on their homes Thursday. Senator Chris Murphy and Representatives Jim Himes, Joe Courtney, John Larson, and Johanna Hayes all reported being the subject of such threats. Police who responded said they found no evidence of explosives on the lawmakers' properties. The bomb threats against Democrats happened a day after a number of President-elect Donald Trump's most prominent cabinet picks and appointees reported that they had received such threats, as well as swatting attacks in which perpetrators initiate an emergency law enforcement response against a victim under false pretenses. I'm Norman Hall.
International coffee traders are watching anxiously as Brazil-based traders Atlantica and Coffee Bras are seeking to negotiate their debt with creditors in court after being hit by a surge in global Arabica coffee bean prices. Reuters correspondent Sierra Lee reports.
Arabica coffee futures on the ICE exchange, which is used to price beans around the world, are at their highest in nearly half a century. That's on fears that the upcoming crop in top producer Brazil has been damaged by this year's drought. Some farmers have, as a result, delayed deliveries in hope of securing even higher prices. Atlantica and Café Brás this week said in a statement they were seeking to restructure their debt. Traders believe they will not be the last to face these problems and that this will drive coffee prices even higher and eventually filter through to consumers. Arabica coffee is the world's second most valuable commodity after oil.
That was Reuters correspondent Sierra Lee reporting. That wraps up this news update, but the world and the news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Jeff Custer, VOA News.
Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
At the end of the day, though, you've got to deal with who you've got in power. And the reality is that Angola is an opportunity for the United States to break China's stranglehold on the acquisition of minerals there in Africa. We've paid too little attention to Africa for far too long. It's a critical continent, not just for American economic and national security purposes, but for the global economy.
That was Jamal Jaffar, director of the National Security Initiative in Washington, D.C., talking about the U.S. partnering with Angola. Details coming up. Also, Namibians continue to vote in the national elections after technical problems marred Election Day on Wednesday, and the East Africa community marks its 25th anniversary. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. Namibians returned to vote today in 36 reopened polling stations 2 days after the country's election was marred by technical problems. I asked reporter Vitalio Angula in Namibia's capital Windhoek a little while ago about the general mood in the country and if the delays in the voting were escalating tensions in the historically stable and peaceful Southern African nation.
What happened is that not everybody got a chance to vote. I think the ECN, which is the Electoral Commission of Namibia, did not anticipate the high voter turnout and also in different areas. So what the government did, not what the government did, but what the ECN did, the Electoral Commission of Namibia and the president, is to say that we are going to extend the election date for 2 more days, because that's a problem we had. That when police stations closed, people were not able to vote. So they've decided to extend the period.
There was also this news about technical problems, including issues with tablets used to register voters and shortages of ballot papers. Talk to us a little about the technical problems.
The technical problem, the voter verification tablet, it seems to heat. The more you use it, the more it heats. The problem is when it heats up, then it doesn't work anymore. So we had that, and it was reported even with the SADC mission and even with the EU mission that this has been a problem, and some people had to wait for their tablets to cool down, or some people had to wait for tablets to be brought from another station or for the IT guy to come and fix it. But these are documented problems. It did happen. Yeah, unfortunately, voting was delayed because of technical glitches.
And Vitalio, the opposition parties were scheduled to meet today and issue a joint statement. Has that happened yet?
Today, I have not received yet an invitation, but I'm sure the political parties will come because of the Namibian democratic system. I think they have been giving the political parties a chance to come and air their grievances. But it's just that it's a time where all the resources are deployed. So sometimes you call a meeting and then the other person is not available.
And Vitalio, how about the ruling party, SWAPO? Any statement from the ruling party?
The ruling party has not given a statement. Other parties, the only party which is the one which seems that they are second in running, Independent Patriots of Change, they have issued a statement where they say they are going to bring this matter over to court. But I think it's too early, and with the ruling party being the party in government, it will be very difficult for them to give a statement, because they would want to allow the ECN, the Electoral Commission of Namibia, to do their work.
And lastly, Vitalio, facing criticism from both voters and the parties, what has the Electoral Commission said so far about the whole technical problems, the delay in voting? And they are actually telling Namibians they can vote until Saturday evening.
Yes, I think with the Electoral Commission, they did acknowledge the problem and they moved to sort out the problems. They have heard the cries of the people. People were not able to vote on time at the designated station. But the problem is the 36 polling stations that they have designated now, they are actually more central. I think they did it for their own convenience. But people in Namibia is one of the most sparsely populated countries in the world, I think after Mongolia. People have to travel, so political parties are busing people in, and they are also saying, if you have a problem with transport and you want to vote, tell us your number, we'll come and pick you up and we'll take you there.
That was Victalio Angula in Namibia talking to me from the capital, Windhoek. Joe Biden visits Angola next week in what will be his first and last visit to Africa as president of the United States. His administration has forged close economic ties with the oil-rich Southern African country, but the two countries were once bitter opponents. Darren Taylor reports.
The United States is investing billions of dollars in the Lobito Corridor project, its biggest rail infrastructure build in Africa. Washington is the main financer of a 1,300-kilometer line that will eventually link the Democratic Republic of Congo, Zambia, and Angola. The railway will transport critical minerals from the DRC and Zambia to the Angolan port of Lobito on the Atlantic Ocean to be shipped on to the U.S. and Europe. These minerals, including cobalt, lithium, and copper, are used in cell phones, laptops, and clean energy technology, especially electric vehicle batteries. Jamil Jaffa, director of the National Security Initiative in Washington, D.C., says it makes sense for the U.S. to partner with Angola, even though President João Lourenço's administration has been accused of political repression, which his government denies.
At the end of the day, though, you've got to deal with who you've got in power, and the reality is that Angola is an opportunity for the United States to break China's stranglehold on the acquisition of minerals there in Africa. We've paid too little attention to Africa for far too long. It's a critical continent, not just for American economic and national security purposes, but for the global economy.
Jaffa was speaking on a recent National Security Initiative webinar. President Joe Biden hosted Lourenço at the White House in November 2023, something that would not have happened in the 1970s and 1980s. During the Cold War period, the U.S. supported armed groups fighting Lourenço's Soviet-backed and communist MPLA in Angola's long civil war. Dr. Francis Brown is the Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for African Affairs at the White House National Security Council. She says Angola now is a strategic partner and regional leader.
Our relationship with Angola has completely transformed over the past 30 years, and that transformation has really picked up pace over the last 3 years. In 2023, U.S.-Angola trade totaled approximately $1.77 billion, which makes Angola our fourth largest trade partner in sub-Saharan Africa. We're also working with Angola to address a range of pressing challenges, including bolstering peace and security in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, growing economic opportunities in the region, and expanding technological and scientific cooperation.
Some regional analysts see the Lobito Railway as the opening shot in Washington's response to China's Belt and Road Initiative. Under the BRI, Beijing has constructed railways, roads, and bridges across Africa, cementing its status as the continent's largest trade partner. During an online media briefing this week, Brown emphasized deals with Angola or any African country don't mean the U.S. expects Africans to cut or minimize ties with China.
This approach is not about forcing countries to choose, but rather giving them a choice and the ability to make their own sovereign decisions. We believe that the value proposition we offer from the U.S. side on trade, investment, but also partnership, people-to-people ties, demonstrate the value of partnership with the U.S. for both Angola and the Angolan people. And more broadly, we think this pertains to other African counterparts as well. We act in common purpose to advance shared interests and values and to address issues that are, I think, real problems for African counterparts, like untrusted digital infrastructure, forced labor, illegal and unregulated fishing. So that's, I think, how we from the Biden administration see it.
The U.S. State Department says in addition to talking up the Lobito Corridor deal, Biden will talk about American efforts to strengthen democracy and anti-corruption efforts in the country. He'll also highlight his administration's $900 million pledge to develop solar energy in Angola. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
As celebrations to mark the 25th anniversary of the East African community get underway in Arusha, Tanzania, there is a push for partner states to eliminate barriers that impede cross-border trade to enhance regional economic growth. From the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, Ruben Chama reports.
Highlight of the celebrations will be a high-level summit on Saturday at the East African Community headquarters in Arusha to be attended by the leaders of the EAC states. Veronica Nduva is the EAC Secretary General.
The EAC is celebrating 25 years since it restarted again. You know very well the EAC was there in 1967 to 77, and then there was a stop. It paused, and for about 30 years, nothing happened. So this year, which is 25 years since it started, it's a perfect opportunity to reflect on the journey that we have taken, to look at what have been our achievements, what have been our challenges, and where do we hope to move forward.
There are 8 EAC states: Burundi, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Kenya, Rwanda, Somalia, South Sudan, Uganda, and Tanzania. That makes it one of Africa's largest economic blocs. Marie Angelique Umulisa is the EAC Principal Trade Officer.
Over the past 20 years, EAC's exports have increased from $1 billion to just over $8 billion. The EAC has been actively involved in the African Continental Free Trade Area, which brings together 55 African countries, a combined population of 1.4 billion people, and a GDP of $3 trillion. The aim is to create a larger single African market for goods and services.
Umulisa says partner states have already agreed on harmonizing their trade rules. However, as the celebrations get underway, some say the regional bloc has yet to realize its full trade potential. Kisembo Ronex Tendo is the Chief Executive Officer of Africa Mashariki First, an organization that engages the youth to embrace regional integration through art and sport. He challenged the leaders from the EAC member states to lift barriers to promote free trade, improve regional integration, and facilitate free movement of people within the region.
In terms of policy formulation, but implementation and domestication of the gospel of regional integration needs to be actualized. And this is only when the young people are empowered, when the young people are supported, this is when we can be able to realize that dream.
The EAC traces its origins to the mid-20th century when Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania formed cooperative ties through shared services such as the East African Railways in 1948. In 1967, shortly after the three nations gained independence, they established the EAC to foster economic cooperation and integration across East Africa. But differing political and economic policies among the partner states led to the dissolution of the initial bloc in 1977. The treaty to re-establish the East African Community was signed in Arusha on November 30, 1999, and came into force in July 2000. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There, you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1 202 258 3076. Every Wednesdays, we'll be sharing our listeners' comments on Africa News Tonight. Thank you. An expert on security issues in the Horn of Africa says the ongoing internal conflicts in Ethiopia are worrying for the country as well as for the region broadly, given how central Ethiopia is to regional dynamics, regional peace and regional stability. I spoke recently with Michael Waldemariam, an associate professor in the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland and a senior fellow at the Center for International and Security Studies.
But it does appear to me that the conflict in Ethiopia, the multiple conflicts in Ethiopia, are also in a stalemated phase. So, you know, you have the ongoing armed conflict in the Amhara region, armed groups in Oromia that remain quite active. And the government's kind of repeated efforts to quell these rebellions, I think, has not worked. I think that's a reasonable assessment to make. Nor does it appear that some of these armed groups are in a position necessarily to displace the government. And so
the question then becomes, Professor Waldemariam says, is whether this military stalemate will shift toward beginning a broader national dialogue that can produce a sustainable political settlement for the country. He notes there are concerns about the two-year-old agreement that ended a bloody conflict between the Ethiopian National Government and the Tigray People Liberation Front.
You know, I'd also point out there are other parts of Ethiopia that are also at risk of escalating conflict. You probably followed the situation in Tigray after Pretoria. I mean, Pretoria was a success in many ways, but that is an arrangement that could also be upended given some of the kind of internal the challenges around implementing aspects of Pretoria, some of the internal divisions within Tigray within the TPLF that we've seen. There's also, you know, the issues in, you know, perhaps worrying trends in the Somali region of Ethiopia as well. That's been quiet and stable for a number of years, but there are disagreements, it appears, between, you know, the Ethiopian federal authorities and the ONLF. And then, of course, you know, the tension between Ethiopia and Somalia might feed into some of the internal issues in the Somali region of Ethiopia.
Professor Waldemariam concludes his thoughts by saying the internal questions in Ethiopia remain a concern. He hopes the inability of any of the political players to obtain the upper hand militarily can create some space for dialogue, which he says would help the country and the region. The World Trade Organization today reappointed Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala to lead the group based on her leadership on breaking log jams with dynamism and sheer force of personality. The World Bank veteran, Nigeria's first woman finance minister, and is the first woman and the first African to run the WTO. Okonjo-Iweala has pulled off some breakthroughs at the global trade body, notably sealing a long-stalled deal on curbing subsidies for harmful fishing practices. The Nigerian-born Okonjo-Iweala is a development economist by training. She graduated from Harvard University and holds a doctoral degree from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
And now, time for our sports wrap-up. I have in studio VOA sports analyst Mokbil Yabaro. Welcome to African News Tonight, Mokbil.
Thanks for having me, Yehez.
So in football news, both the Champions League and Europa League were back in action this week. What were some big results?
I'm going to have to start with the bounce back from my club, Arsenal. They were able to win big 5-1 against Sporting Lisbon. This is a team that has been on fire in Europe. They are at the top of the Portuguese league. They have a manager by the name, or had, I should say, a manager by the name of Ruben Amorim, who in his last Champions League match fixture, his very last Champions League matchup against Manchester City, were able to beat Manchester City 4-1. And this is Man City. They are going through a bit of a spill. So coming back and facing another Premier League team, they were feeling confident. But then they had lost their manager, who now became the new manager of Manchester United. So, you know, some of our colleagues really support that Manchester United team. So now they think that this new manager is the top guy. We'll see what he's able to do. So, that big result, Arsenal 5-1. Another huge result, Atalanta played and beat the Young Boys 6-1. You have Zvezda beating Stuttgart 5-1. So there were some huge results. Liverpool also, big win against Real Madrid, winning 2-0. First time they beat Real Madrid since 2009, Yehez. So, you know, we've seen some really, really big games from the Champions League side. On the Europa League side, the manager that I was just talking about right now, Ruben Amorim, who went over to Manchester United, just got his first win in the Europa League against a team called Bode Glimt. They won 3-2. It was a very back-and-forth type of game, but his tactics have shown, really, that maybe he doesn't necessarily have the personnel for the team just yet, but he's doing really well with what he has. And lastly, Tottenham versus Roma was a very, very interesting game. It ended up 2-2.
And change of venue here, Mokbil, in the NBA. There are some unlikely league leaders on both the East and the West. Can you tell us more on that?
Yes, clearly this seems to be the story that we've been talking about for weeks and weeks, and this team still is managing to stay at the top of the pack. Mm. The Cleveland Cavaliers are 17-2, only having lost yesterday to the Atlanta Hawks with point guard and really an amazing player, Trae Young, who put up 20 points and 20 assists in order to beat this team. So it really shows you that teams have to dig deep and make sure that they're getting everybody involved in order to have a chance against this Cavalier team that are playing really, really, really well. The defending champions, the Celtics, are in second place right now with 15 wins and only 3 losses as well. You can guarantee that they will be hanging around for a while as well. And lastly, the Oklahoma City Thunder on the west side and the Houston Rockets are both number 1 and number 2. Maybe some folks expected the Thunder, but not the Houston Rockets.
And lastly, Mokbil, Thanksgiving Day wouldn't be the same without American football. How did the games turn out?
Absolutely, yes. You know, we don't really chat as much about American football on the program as much as maybe some Americans would love. But Thanksgiving games were very interesting, to say the least. The Green Bay Packers won 30-17 against the Miami Dolphins. The New York Giants versus the Cowboys went 27-20 in favor of the Cowboys. And the Detroit Lions were able to beat the Chicago Bears 23-20.
VOA sports analyst Mokbil Yabaro, thank you for your input. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehez Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer Mokbil Yabaro and our engineer Cornelius Tanner, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.